Thank you, David. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My name's Dion.
Hey, Dion.
Everybody say, yo.
Yo.
Make me comfortable. It's good to be back. Thanks for having us back. Ben and I shared our experience, strength, and hope up here, about a year ago? It was great. We had a great time. And love David and Kathy, and it's just great to be here. Good to see you. You guys look good. They're taping this tonight, and I'm like shaking in my boots. I mean, never been taped. I came into AA April 1st, 1968, and never been taped or CD'd or whatever they call it.
In AA.
And we're on, we're going to share the first step here. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And I think I ought to start out by saying, and I think I speak for Ben too. Well, I'm mostly. I'm not an expert. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a scholar. I'm not an academic. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a know-it-all. I really, truly see myself as a student of the program. And I think I know I speak for Ben because we just love the steps. We love the fellowship. And we love the program. And it's like we're forever students of it because it's just so deep and rich and wide and beautiful as you could, as you mine it, you know, it's just, you get so much from it. So we love it. And we have the big book tells us precisely how we have, how the first 100 people in AA recovered, and that's the main purpose of the book. And I just want to say a few things before we start that, one, I'm a real alcoholic, but I'm not a pure alcoholic. I came in, I dabbed in a lot of different stuff, you know, the dry drugs, the sticking it, the snorting it, the drinking it, shooting it, whatever it was. But I'm a real alcoholic. I cannot drink. I die if I drink. I have the disease that they talked about, the threefold disease, physical, synology, and the way it was explained to me is you're born with this predisposition. I don't process alcohol normally, quite abnormal. I just know people in my family that can't even drink. Like my parents, I come from a background, my mom and dad did not drink, they did not smoke, they didn't drink coffee, they just argued 24 hours a day. You know, but both my grandfathers, now that I've been in AA long, I think I said I came in April 1st, 1968, and that's a significant date for me. It's April Fool's Day, and I think booze and drugs and were the biggest fooler in my life. You know, I thought I found heaven and woke up one day and I was in hell. And it was painful. So the physical allergy, I cannot use. I cannot drink alcohol or use drugs, you know, self-prescribed drugs. You know what I'm talking about. If I indulge in that, the mental obsession kicks in. For some reason, I can't get enough. One is too many, 1,000 isn't enough. And the spiritual part of the disease for me is I get shut off from life totally. I become totally selfish, self-centered, fearful, dishonest, inconsiderate. I'm just totally absorbed with self and decisions based on self. And I just don't see straight. And I don't know anybody else is in the room and has feelings. And that's the way I ended up. At the end of my drinking career, it was driven by fears. I had 1,000 forms of fear. I think I spent 24 hours a day trying to outrun my fears at the end of the 60s before I came in. My mother always said, you were perfect until the age of 13. And I don't know what happened. What happened? I think I started drinking. I did. I remember the first day I drank, I had a friend, his parents owned a liquor store. They went out of town, he had a bottle of gin, and we were mixing it with chocolate syrup to get it down. Traumatic experience. But I walked out of that apartment building, you know, and I come from Bronx, New York, and, you know, the code of the streets was reputation and respect. It was in like an unwritten, but as I always say, it had nothing to do with character. It just had to do with intimidation and trying to look cool. You know, it didn't matter what you knew. You just looked like you knew everything, or you tried to look like, you know. So I walk out. After having a few of these gins, I walk out into the middle of the street, walking up the white line of Crotone Avenue in the Bronx. Feeling like I was running for governor, you know, I'm like looking at the tenement buildings from the middle of the street and giving everybody a wave, you know, like everything's cool, I have it all under control. And I walked into the corner candy store, Moach's candy store, you know, where Frankie Yunk Yunk and Joe Beady Eyes and Ralph and Moach hung out. And there was Susan. Susan's sitting here tonight. I know Susan for 50 years. We've been married for 42 of those years. And there she was. She had moved down from Vermont. And I didn't know they grew anything as beautiful as Susan up in Vermont. And I met her that day, and I put my collar up, and I started talking some stuff you wouldn't believe. And I was the most insecure, because I come from a home where, you know, I don't think my father ever, my dad, my parents had wonderful qualities, but I don't think my father ever grew past the age of 13 emotionally. And he grew old, but he didn't grow up. You know, like a lot of us. You know, when I came into AA, that's exactly the way I was. An emotional 13-year-old, a 12-year-old. So they didn't know how to handle their feelings. That's why they argued. They had no idea how to do life, you know. They did it a certain way. And they argued. And when I started talking to Sue, when I had a couple of drinks in me, I felt like, yo, the kid is here. What do you want to know? I just know everything, you know. I felt good. I felt good. And I felt like I knew everything I could. And, you know, I don't know what we were talking about, but I felt like I was doing great. And that's the reason why I went back to it the next day and the next day and the next day until I came into this program very, very beaten down and very frustrated and full of fears and frustration, because I never grew. I never grew up. You know, I walked into this program. I fought against the idea of my life being unmanageable by me. Like they say, there's three stages to alcoholism. First stage is a lot of fun. I mean, it is like, wow, this is cool. And the second stage is, this is fun, but I'm starting to have some problems. And the third stage is nothing but problems. And that's how AA found me. And they, little by little, they stripped away all my false dependencies, because I was dependent on all kinds of things, on all kinds of false dependencies. And if your God is false, you'll become false. And that's the way they found me. I was like a phony. I was living on pride because I had all these fears. I had all these fears, and I was trying to outrun them. I didn't know how to deal with them. I didn't know how to face pain. I didn't know what to do with it. So I denied it, and I lived on pride. And that's the insanity. The insanity was I lied to myself. I told myself I was something. I didn't see myself accurately. And when you do that, when you live like that and you don't acknowledge your fear, you make unreasonable demands on God, on yourself, on other people. It's like you whirl through people. You just whirlwind like a tornado. You run through people. So I was driven by these fears and running from the pain and didn't know how to handle these emotions, and I was doing all the things I wanted to do, I couldn't do. All the things I didn't want to do, I'd end up doing. And every day I'd say, tomorrow I'm going to change. And I just didn't know how to get there. And I started to feel very alone. And you start pushing people away from you. And I was really hurting at the end of my drinking. And I met a guy who was sober 14 years. I moved down to Florida here, and this is after I was at the top of my profession. I had made some records in the late 50s and 60s, made a lot of money, was traveling all over the world, trying to impress Susan to the utmost, and she's going, is this all you want? I don't know what she was talking about. You know, these people from Vermont, they're kind of simple. He was like, is this it? I'm like, what do you want? More flowers? More, what do you want? But here I am trying to impress her and really spiraling down real fast and suicide on the installment plan. And we moved down to Florida, where my father-in-law lived. He lived down here, and I never knew him. I didn't want to know him. I didn't want to know anybody who looked me in the eyes and said good morning. I didn't know what they were talking about at the end of my drink. I thought they would look right through me and see me as a phony, of course. So, but he knew I was hurting, and eventually got me into the, asked me to come to the meetings. And I came in, and I heard, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I said to Jack, what's the path? And he told me, he said, do you know when they wrote that line in the big book, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It said, never have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. He said, they just took that out and kind of, you know, softened it up a bit. He said, but I can tell you, if you follow this path, you'll never have to drink again. And you'll know a life free from the bondage of self. You'll be free. You could live a happy, joyous life. And I trusted the guy because he was there. I knew because he used to tell me stories of his drinking, how he lost his business, how his family, was hurt, the whole bit. So I came in, and then, as Ben always says, and they told us that the 12 steps are designed to free us from the bondage of self and to lead us. The 12 steps are designed to lead us into union with God. And God created us in such a way only to work well when we're in union with Him. It's like working on all 8 cylinders, you know, instead of the 2 I was putting along on, you know. And when I say putting along, when I was drinking, I tried to control situations, circumstances, and conditions to my entire satisfaction. I would try to control everything and try to kind of move people around so I could get what I want and get some peace if they'd only do what I want. I was like the great director. But it got worse and worse. The more I exerted that kind of control, the worse they'd get, the more out of control people. Couldn't get them in place, and I drink more and more, and got crazier and crazier. And Jack told me something about the first step was admitting complete defeat. I come from the Bronx. The word surrender is a dirty word. You don't surrender. I don't care if somebody's got your head and they're pounding it on the cement. You do not surrender. The whole neighborhood will call you names. So you develop a hard head and you swing and you don't surrender. Period. You know, it's like right to the core of your being. You know, and I was brought up, I always heard the words, be self-sufficient, be self-confident and all that. But you know as well as I do, it doesn't go far enough. There's something that, it just doesn't go far enough. When I got to AA, I was hopeless. My will was a liability. I was sitting with my father-in-law, and he looked straight at me. He said, you are too strong for your own good. He said, your will is like iron. He said, you'll walk through walls. You walk through people. You could live out on the street. I can't live like that. Your will is a liability at this point. You know, that's where I was at. I was just closed off to everybody. I was on like a one-way track, you know, to destruction. And I was running out of excuses. I had about a 15-year career of drinking and drugging. And getting crazy, and the pain, and the loneliness, and feeling so separated. You know, like, it's the book puts it well. Let me read this. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontent. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once from taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. And that's where I was. I just kept, the cycle kept going around and around and around. And I was on my way, thank God, to hitting the bottom. And this is what we mean by hitting the bottom. The way I like to put it is I came to an end of my life on my terms. I came to an end of my life on my terms. It was over. It wasn't like I had a little bit of a disease and I had to stop drinking and get a little bit of recovery. I had to die. I used to go to my sponsor. I said, I feel like I'm dying. He went, good. I said, I'm going to shake apart. I can't sleep. He said, listen, I've never seen anybody shake apart. I've never seen an arm over on that side of the corner and a leg over there. He said, if you can't sleep at night, walk to Fort Lauderdale. I said, you don't understand. I feel like I'm dying. Good. And they told me, go to a doctor who understands this disease because you got the eye once. My brother, you got the eye once. So I went to a guy who understood, and he comforted me, but he didn't hand me a bunch of, you know, I would have tried to get something from him. You know what I'm talking about. Some kind of comfort and some drugs, you know, because that was part of my addiction. And they told me, like that first step reads, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That was hard to admit complete defeat. I mean, 100%. But I had so much pain, people, I never wanted to go back there. And they told me, lean into the pain. Lean into it like a skier leans into the mountain. You don't pull back. You lean into it. You go with it. Pain is a touchstone of spiritual growth. Don't pull back. Don't try to run from it. Lean into it. Get that sponsor and head on into it. And that's where the growth is. Whoa, who the hell? I didn't learn this on the corner. I knew how to fight, and I knew how to run, and I knew how to curse people. I knew how to walk around going, that guy's a real jerk off. This guy's a real, you know, I knew how to talk about people. I just did not know how to grow up. I didn't know how to do anything grown up. I wasn't a grown up, I'll tell you that. That our lives had become unmanageable. And the more control I let go of, you know, I found out that my life became more manageable. More control I let go of. Anyway, when I came in and started looking at that step, and my sponsor started talking to me after meetings, and you know, those meetings at Howard Johnson and the coffee and the guys and just throwing it around, I found out that they, you know, said you have to find a power greater than yourself. And there was no power greater than me. And I thought I knew everything. And then they started telling me, you know, I said, yeah, but my father, baby, yeah, my mother, you have to find a power greater than your parents. You have to find a power greater than the doctor. You have to find a power greater than your business. You know, I was like looking, you know, to impress people and be accepted and all. You have to find a higher power. And just let me do a... It says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happy and useful and whole. And it says, who cares to admit complete defeat? I was so against my nature. But when they told me I was suffering from a disease, and I wasn't at ease, I had a disease, we perceived that only through utter defeat are we able to take our first steps towards liberation and strength. Our admissions of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be the firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. We know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all its consequences, until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. Of real happiness, he will find none at all, proved beyond doubt by an immense experience. This is one of the facts of AA life. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered. And I didn't know what the hell they were talking about, that the strength was going to come from my weakness. I had no idea what they were talking about. And I was looking all over the place and talking to my sponsor. And this surrender, they kept talking about surrender, surrender. I went to church one day, and I heard God's strength. They were right out of the scripture. This guy, Paul, had a thorn in his flesh, and he was praying, and God said, "My grace is sufficient for you." So he went around saying, "I'm going to brag about my weaknesses because I found God in admitting my weaknesses, not in admitting my strengths. Every time I was prideful, he was nowhere around." That's why, I found God in the fifth step. We'll get to that later, but God's strength is made perfect in my weakness, this priest said. I went back to AA. I told my sponsor, "What does that mean, God's strength is made perfect in my weakness?" I didn't know what it meant. I know today what it means. Because in the book, it says that when we turn our will and our life over to the care of God, I mean, you know, being powerless, you got to go somewhere. And I didn't know when I first came in. I don't want to get ahead of the first step. But this getting close to God, this humility, the book says, is a healer of pain. Humility is a healer of pain. And I had so much pain and so much fear. And today, I got to tell you, just before I turn it over to Ben, to be honest with you, I am free. I could sit up here and tell you I am free. And I'm 66. And I feel stronger than when I came in at 28. I mean, I feel free. I feel confident. And I in the love of secure in God's love and my friendships. There's so many people I see here tonight. Mm-hmm. They kiss me when they see me. These ugly guys. They come over and I got all this stuff. But I got friends. I got, my wife and I fall more deeply in love every day, I'm telling you. She calls me the real deal. Imagine that. It took 50 years for her to say that. And I'm going to get a shirt. Real deal. I got up this morning and said, "Hey, the real deal is up." Anyway, thanks for listening to me. I love you.
The real deal. I'm impressed. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name is Ben. And it really is nice to be back. This is kind of like a home away from home for us, and to see Steve and some old friends like George, and by old I mean that go back a long time, not that he's old, that just recently moved back to this area, and Bud, who's come down, and it's like being home. And thank you for the privilege of joining us in this journey through the steps. And I heard a while back that if we learn to laugh at ourselves, we'll never be without amusement. So So toward that end, I'd like to share a couple of quick thoughts, as I try and do every week. This is wisdom of life, and I'll just share a few of them. Sex is like air. It's not important unless you aren't getting any. Before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you're a mile away and you have their shoes. If at first you don't succeed, skydiving is not for you. If you lend somebody $20 and never see that person again, it was worth it. And there's a lot of them that are cute, but the last one is perhaps the best. Everyone seems normal until you get to know them. So, Dion mentioned that it is our thesis that these 12 steps are a journey toward union with God. And we arrived at that, and as he said, we don't pretend to be, you know, teachers here. We are simply students who have been taught by others and have discovered some things which we'd like to share with you from our own experience or our own reading of our literature. But Carl Jung, the great psychiatrist who was the first great psychiatric friend of AA, actually spent 1932 and 1933 giving some psychiatric help to a fellow named Roland Hazard, who was a chronic, hopeless alcoholic. And he finally told Roland that there was no help for him in the psychiatric world, that the best he could hope for was occasionally Dr. Jung had seen recovery as a result of a spiritual, profound spiritual experience. He suggested he place himself in some religious or spiritual environment. He was a friend of a man named Eddie Thatcher, also from Connecticut. He brought the message of recovery through the Oscar Group to Ebbie. Ebbie is the one that brought that message to Bill Wilson in Bill's kitchen. And AA, the seeds of AA were born. And in 1961, Bill wrote Carl Jung, and he said, and there's two letters that are in our literature, The Language of the Heart, which you can read for yourself. But Bill wrote and essentially thanked Dr. Jung, and he said, you know, you really are should be considered one of the founding fathers of AA because of the message that you gave to Roland. And so we in AA are forever grateful to you for the contribution you made. And Dr. Jung wrote back, and he said that Ebbie's craving for alcohol was equivalent, on a low level, of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval terms, the union with God. And that was what Dr. Jung suggested the foundation of our disease was, that it was a spiritual thirst for union with God. And so that's where Dion and I originally chose to use that language. And the second great psychiatric friend of AA was Dr. Harry Thiebaud, and you can read about him in AA Comes of Age. But in May of 43, he said this: the therapeutic mechanism of Alcoholics Anonymous, unless the individual gains, in the course of time, a sense of the reality and nearness of a greater power, his egocentric nature will reassert itself with undiminished intensity and draw him again into an alcoholic spiral. And he said the chief characteristics of the alcoholic were narcissistic, eccentric core, feelings of omnipotence, grandiosity, and defiant individuality. Now, how dare he say that about us, a bunch of good folks like us? I especially like the defiant individuality, because that's the one I confuse with independence all the time. And Dion said he was 13 when he came in, and I didn't know him in 68, because I'm the new kid here in this combo. My sobriety date's July 20th of 1979. But my guess is, if he's like most of the other guys I've known in AA, we come and we're about two. You know, we are nowhere close to 13. I mean, we're still trying to get our hands into everything, and, you know, we don't want to be stopped, and don't say no, and, And we're just held down for election on what we want when we want when we want it. And certainly that's the way I was. So if that is the case, the wonderful news for me, and I think the wonderful news for you, is that I am powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. And my God, what a wonderful, beautiful, poetic, musical truth that is. Because I have a disease wherein the prison door unlocks from the inside. And that key to that lock was put in my hand when I was finally beaten to the point with chronic alcoholic hepatitis where I surrendered. And I gave up. And I said, I am powerless over this stuff. I can't not drink. And I'm killing myself. And my life is an absolute shambles. And I am unable to do anything to change it on my own. And so in North Broward Hospital in May of 1979, literally on my deathbed, I surrendered. And my body rolled before my head caught up with it. So, you know, I can lay no claim to any enlightenment of any kind. I literally was beaten to my knees and beaten into surrender. But, you know, our disease, I love what Dion read. I would have read it had he not. From the doctor's opinion, which in the first edition, it appears as an appendix in the beginning, but it used to be chapter one, the doctor's opinion used to be. And he actually says something else a little further, sort of contrary to some of what I've heard in the rooms. He's talking about people who go back to drinking after stopping, and he said these men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And AA is not about stopping drinking. AA is about staying stopped. And more importantly, it's about what Dion read in the preface to the 12 and 12, that we've been given a set of steps, spiritual in nature, which will not only expel the obsession to drink, but will render the sufferer happily and usefully whole. This isn't just about not drinking. This is about so much more than not drinking. And the key to that is step one. But I have an allergy. Because I'm an alcoholic. And an allergy, I thought, gee, I'm going to, you know, look into this allergy business. An allergy is an abnormal or pathological reaction to environmental factors or substances. And my mom had an allergy to strawberries. And if she ate strawberries, she'd get hives in her throat and would swell up and she could literally die. She had an abnormal reaction to strawberries. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I don't process alcohol the way a non-alcoholic does. And by example, a normal drinker, whatever that might be, have a couple of drinks and they get sleepy or relaxed and they want to go to bed. I have a few drinks, I get energized and want to go to town. You know, they feel out of control. Drinking made me feel in control. They would get nauseated. It would create in me the phenomenon of craving. Their bodies are trying to expel it. My body is saying more. They got confused and I would have striking clarity. I mean, philosophical insights of incredible, incredible brilliance and importance. The problem was I couldn't remember them. Damn. I mean, I had conversations in bars at night and we would resolve serious, serious issues. But alas, it was lost in the night. And, you know, a normal drinker will go to a party, have a few drinks, get a little tipsy, and they'll lose a drink. You know, I have a few drinks, and I lose a car. So we have an abnormal reaction, and it is, you know, I'm not a doctor, I don't pretend to be a doctor, but I like to read, and so it is my understanding that as an alcoholic, I lack one enzyme that's been identified, which breaks down acetone into its component parts, and I have an abundance of another enzyme called cytochrome P450, for whoever's taking notes, which breaks down alcohol into excessive amounts of toxic acetaldehyde. Alcohol, when it breaks down to acetaldehyde, to diacetic acid, to acetone, and finally to CO2, sugar, and water. My problem is I have one enzyme that doesn't burn the acetone like a normal drinker does, and I have another chromosome that produces more acetaldehyde and thus more acetone than the normal drinker. And it is this recycled acetone that creates the phenomenon of craving in the neural synapses. It's a physiological reality. That's also why, as we age, and these are produced by the liver, these enzymes, as we age, our liver becomes less productive. And that's why you take an alcoholic and have him stop drinking, and have him pick up drinking 10 years later, and within that fast, he will not only be where he was when he left, quit, he'll be further along. The reason is his body is even less capable of breaking down the acetone now than it was 10 years ago. It is true that when we stop and start again, we don't start all over. We start where we left off and maybe then some. And I've seen it happen time and again. So there is a physiological, legitimate reason for this. If that were the case, and we knew it to be true, why would I ever pick up a drink, as the doctor's opinion suggests? And that's because this problem is twofold. You know, we not only have a physiological component that creates the phenomenon of craving when I ingest it, but I also have a thinker, an obsession for alcohol. And I'm told in the big book that I have a disease that's centered primarily in my mind. This is where the obsession exists. And it has to do with the wonderful experience I got, as Dion read in the doctor's opinion, when I drank alcohol early in life. It was wonderful. I mean, I didn't drink till I got to college. And I went east to college. I was raised in the Midwest. I felt out of place. I didn't belong. I didn't belong a lot of places. But I didn't belong there. But we'd go into New York City, and once I found beverage alcohol, I'd have about a six-pack between New Jersey and New York City. And by the time I got to, you know, New York City, you know, the Minnesota cowboy was here. I mean, it's like, you know, it's Yo, the kid is here. Well, I was a Minnesota cowboy, and I was cool. I mean, the pimples came off. You know, I gained about 25 pounds of muscle, got to be the love master. I mean, I was a thing to behold. I craved that. My mind told me that I could retrieve that feeling again. I could get that same feeling if I drank again. And I would forget that I didn't get that feeling, and I would continue to reach for that feeling. The obsession would tell me. And it was coupled with my nature, which was, as Dion said, was driven by 1,000 forms of protective fear. The reason my life was unmanageable, and you know, that's a separate thought. When I first heard this step, and understand, when I got out of the hospital and into AA, I had like 2 operating brain cells. One spoke French and one played ragtime. You know? So I heard that first step, and what I heard was, you know, I was powerless over alcohol, and I was real clear on that one. And therefore, my life was unmanageable. But that's not what it says. It's 2 distinct thoughts separated by a semicolon. I was powerless over alcohol, and simultaneously, My life was unmanageable. The reason my life was unmanageable was because from as far back as I can remember, I never felt like I really fit in and really belonged. I always felt somehow marginally less than or defective. I knew that it was critically important to look cool, much more important to look cool than to be cool. I was afraid of being found out. I was afraid of them, whoever them was, never identified, but very real nonetheless. They crop up even now, if you aren't careful. They come at about 3 in the morning, in case you notice. You know, when you're laying there trying to mind your own business to go to sleep, you know, and all your spirituality went to bed with you, but your mind didn't, and it waited patiently until all your prayers went to sleep, and then it says, "Hi! Boy, are you in trouble." And it rehearses all the failures of the past and all the fears of the future, and, you know, and then I'm off and running in my head again. It is remarkable how this fear-driven thinking, you know, can shape everything about us. But as a result, I did not see reality for what it was. The doctor's opinion says I could not distinguish true from false. That's a fact. I would shape reality so that I could cope with it and minimize my fear. My behavior would be adjusted to respond in the environment I was in so that I would save myself from the things I was most afraid of. That is not a formula for happy and successful living. I tried it. It does not work. I wound up on my deathbed. Now, maybe you found a better solution. But the only solution I found was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill says things in a couple of other places besides what we've quoted already. In A Comes of Age, he says, the loss of one's old life is a condition for finding a new one. Would seem to be self-evident, but I've never heard it quite said that way before. I know he says we've been reborn in the big book, but, you know, I never quite heard it put that way. The loss of one's old life is a condition, a requirement. If you don't lose your old life, you won't get a new one. It's that simple. It starts with this step one. He says, our admissions of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be the firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. That's why I say the good news is that I am powerless over alcohol and that my life has become unmanageable. And that statement is the bedrock for me of a way of life, which indeed has helped me to become purposeful and happy. And this has come about because of the 12-step journey that has led me away from the bondage of the disease of alcoholism. And notice it's alcoholism, not alcoholism. Okay? Also, because of the mental component, people who simply stop drinking are not sober, they are undrunk. Sobriety comes, meaning soundness of mind, comes through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we don't change our thinking completely, the profound psychic change that we're talked about in you know, that the psychiatrist talks about, or William James talks about, if we don't have that, we may not drink, but people will pray that we do. And I'm sure I'm sure we've all met them. God bless them. You know, you really hope that some crisis happens, you know, and they give up, and they become teachable. How do you know somebody's taken the first step successfully? I don't know. I mean, none of us have a button that goes from red to green, you know. But I do know this. I know that if somebody is teachable, if they're willing to take the actions suggested by their sponsor and by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if they are willing to be open-minded, if even only a little, especially on this matter of a relationship with God, then, in my opinion, they have made a terrific start, at least, on the first step. Just to the extent that I want to work my recovery my way, I have turned my back on step one, and I have rewritten it to shape my own drives and desires and needs. And just to close with a thought, as I'm sure you know in the big book, the doctor's opinion and Bill's story are step one in the big book. That's where step one is discussed. Okay? Doctor's opinion, Bill's story. And in Bill's story, he's talking about the fact that Evie came to him and met in his kitchen. And this is also where the steps appear for the first time in the big book. For those of you who may not know, the steps don't just appear on page 59, they appear on page 12 and 13. And Bill recites every single one of them, talking about what Evie said to him. And he says, after the steps have been discussed, he says, my friend promised, when these things were done, these steps, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. What answered all his problems? A new way of living predicated on a new relationship with his Creator. This is not optional in AA. It's like baking a cake. You know, it's no different than any other program which has prescribed actions and prescribed ingredients. If you want to bake a cake and it says, you know, put two eggs in, you better put two eggs in. I mean, you only put in one egg or no eggs, and guess what? You know, you can pretend you baked a cake, but, you know, I'm not going to eat it. You know, knock yourself out. I'd just like to close with a prayer, and probably at most of these nights, Dion or myself will be sharing something of a spiritual nature, something that has been helpful to us, something that's been meaningful to us. And so, given that step one is the entryway into this incredible way of life, which brings a sense of peace and purpose. It brings a sense of serenity, which is to be grasped and enjoyed rather than to be shunned as boring. This is the portal. Step one is the entryway into AA. All of us who are here in AA to stay pass through this portal. And upon completion of this journey, the good news is that we aren't finished. The good news is that we're just on the journey, and the journey is eternal. But I picked this up from Fort Lauderdale Intergroup some years back, and it's called Learning AA. Teach me, my Lord, to be sweet and gentle in all the events of life, in disappointments, in the thoughtlessness of others, in the insincerity of those I trusted, in the unfaithfulness of those on whom I relied. Let me put myself aside to think of the happiness of others, to hide my little pains and heartaches so that I may be the only one to suffer from them. Teach me to profit by the suffering that comes across my path. Let me so use it that it may mellow me, not harden nor embitter me, that it may make me patient, not irritable, that it may make me broad in my forgiveness, not narrow, haughty, and overbearing. May no one be less good for having come within my influence, no one less pure, less true, less kind, less noble, for having been a fellow traveler in our journey toward a sober life. As I go my rounds from one distraction to another, let me whisper from time to time a word of love to thee. May my life be lived in power for good and strong in its purpose. Thank you.